Publishing Legends Network.
Okay, hey everybody. Welcome to the final episode of season three. Now don't get mad and sad and bad. Here's how we're going to do it. We're not taking any time off. So you're still going to get a brand new episode in your feed every 2 weeks during the break. Okay, so we're going to stay right on schedule. There'll be interviews and conversations with all kinds of people, all kinds of weird and spooky topics, but there'll be something new in the feed every 2 weeks straight through the end of the year. Through Thanksgiving, we'll get you through Christmas, New Year's, into January, all the way up to season four, which will launch in late January. Okay. And the Patreon bonus episodes for all you Patreon people, and all the perks and the ad-free episodes and exclusive merch, all that's going to keep rolling right along. Okay. We're a little late on the October bonus episode, so we're going to post that next week, but you'll get it. And I think that's all. Hey, have a great Halloween. And you know what? If you can, just take a few minutes tonight, if you're out there among the festivities, and stand back in the shadows and just look at your neighborhood, watch the show unfold, look up into the sky, take a moment to contact whoever or whatever it is you believe in, and just feel good that we have a thing called Halloween that we can celebrate. Oh, here you go. Here's what happened to me. God, this is like 10 years ago. It was Halloween night. Here's what I did. Owen and Spencer came back from trick-or-treating. And Owen was like, oh, did you see that house down the block? It was up, like two blocks up and way down the street. There was a big elaborate thing. And I didn't go out with them. They went on their own. So he's like, you got to see it. So as things were dying down at our house, and I remembered, I'm like, oh, I want to go check that out. So I go out into the street, and it's that sort of, you know, post-trick-or-treating time when things start to get quiet again, and it's kind of, it's actually sort of even more creepy because no one's on the street. Anyway, I go a couple blocks up, I turn, I go way to the end of the block. I walk all the way down this pretty dark street to get up to the house that's got this big, elaborate, I mean, it's like these hooded figures and these torches with fire. It's a whole tableau. And just as I get up, they're shutting it down. But I got to see it. So now I'm walking back down the street toward my house, and now everything's dark. Everyone has shut down. There's nothing. The decorations are out, but they're all dark. Anyway, so I'm walking down the street, totally alone, and I see something in a tree. It's one of the smaller trees that are planted right along the sidewalk. And so I'm going to come right up to it. And I'm like, what is that? And it's this big black decoration. And it's just sort of jammed in the tree. And I'm like, what is that? And I keep walking and getting closer and closer and closer. And I get up to it and I'm looking at it, and it's a face. And it's a person. And I jump back, and it's this kid just sitting in the tree, like reclining in his vampire costume. And he's been there. He's just been sitting there. I have no idea how long he's been sitting there. And I jump back, and then I'm really scared. And I just said to the kid, you're good. And he looks at me and he doesn't smile. He just says, I know. And then I laugh and continue walking on. And I kept looking back, and he just wasn't moving. Okay. To you, kid, whoever you are, wherever you are, happy Halloween and well played. All right. Here we go. The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts by Joe Fisher. Part 2. One of the first things I ever knew about my friend Michael Principato was that he had a tragic past. The summer before high school, before I knew him, he lost his girlfriend, his first true love, when she died in a plane crash. Michael actually cried when he told me about it. and I realize now that this is probably when I fell in love with him. All right, calm down. Straight guys fall in love with other straight guys all the time. I hope this is not news to you. We get friend crushes. And in our friendships, we feel the whole range of emotions. Jealousy, compassion, competition, devotion, possessiveness, frustration, insecurity, and love. When we feel these things in the context of a romantic relationship, it's a little easier to understand. We expect it. But in a friend relationship, including male and female friend relationships, it can get confusing. For me personally, something gets triggered when I meet someone I like and then find out they're what I call a bird with a broken wing. Sometimes I think this is why I like them in the first place, even before I know that their wing is broken. Like I have an unconscious awareness that actually draws me to people like this. Like they're putting out some chemical or pheromone that only I can smell that says, I have a deep traumatic soul injury. I am a black hole of emotional need. And I'm like, well, sign me up because I was raised by one of those, so I am super attracted to you. When Michael told me about his girlfriend Annabelle, and is there a more tragic name? I felt like some giant emotional piece fell into place for me. Here was a guy who knew pain and loss. I can't express to you how emotionally compelling this was. I mean, I knew I was a swirling mess of emotions and pain, but finally meeting someone else who was too, and who was able to express the kind of feelings I'd spent my entire life trying to hide, I fell in love. Here was a person sharing something very personal and intimate with me. I needed to be worthy of it. I needed to honor and respect and protect it. We were bonded now. I could not let this person down. It was now a year later, and Michael was still evoking huge emotions in me, but now it was more complicated. I was still his sidekick, and that I could handle. And I knew even then I was supporting him emotionally by being his sidekick. But auditions were coming up for Alhambra High School's fall show, The Odd Couple, and we were both trying out for the same role, Felix Unger. One of us was going to get it. I was terrified it would be him, but I was even more terrified it'd be me. Because if that happened, something about our friendship would change. I knew it. And I also knew it wouldn't be good. Joe Fisher's friend from beyond the veil had betrayed him. Ernest had convinced everyone at the channeling sessions hosted at Aviva Newman's Toronto condo that he had recently lived as a Royal Air Force pilot named William Alfred Scott. But Joe had flown to London to check out the facts firsthand and discovered that while many of the details were accurate, no pilot by the name of William Alfred Scott had ever existed. When Joe arrived at that week's channeling session, he steeled himself against any argument Ernest might offer for why he had misled him about such basic facts as his name and his birthday. But Ernest offered an excuse Joe and the others had not anticipated. His lies and misdirections were the result, he said, of panic. He realized that any public confirmation of his previous life could threaten the forward development of his very soul, progress that he had worked very hard on to attain over the course of many lifetimes. Quote, "Not all lives go according to that which we planned, and there are many things that I have had to work out here and am still working out. I do not wish for others to be privy to these things. It is for me to work them out. I am working out some major karma associated with this past lifetime." He's referring to the one he lived during World War II. "And a lot of it is involved with people still on the earthbound plane. Many things were done. Things of impetuous youth. These are things of indiscriminate judgment, things I'm not particularly fond of with regard to that particular lifetime, and I do not wish for that work to be interrupted or impeded because of a curiosity on the part of others. That is why I have covered my tracks, as you might say." The guides had always been very clear about one thing: how every soul through every lifetime is impelled to move forward and evolve. The interactions of the guides in our lives serves the same purpose for us. They don't interact with us lightly. They're not here for their or our amusement. The payment of karmic debt and avoiding accruing more is their chief concern, and it is for this reason that Ernest admitted he became a bit too enamored of sharing certain details of his earthly life and belatedly realized he might have gone too far. All of which made sense to Joe until he remembered that much of the incorrect information was given early in their contact, even as early as their very first night. Before Joe could pursue this any further, Ernest dropped a bombshell, no pun intended, that was so unexpected it cut off any further discussion of his possible lies. He announced he would no longer be able to communicate with any of them because he had made immediate plans to reincarnate. A fetus in southern England had been located for him, a bodily vehicle in ideal circumstances to provide him with the opportunity of repaying some of the karmic debt he had referred to earlier. From the book. Ernest spoke of entering a transitional plane where he said, quote, "You become oriented to locality, time, dates, and once again, structuring your thoughts and making sure that you have with you the information that you need for this lifetime. You have to make sure that you have not overburdened yourself with information you do not in fact need." Ernest remarked that one only takes 7% of one's knowledge into a new existence. Weeks later, after all contact with Ernest had ceased, Russell announced that he could confirm that Ernest had successfully been reborn on the Earth plane. His birth had taken place on July 13th. His name was Thomas Hugh Graham. His birthplace was the county of Kent in southern England, and his parents' names were Hugh and Susan. Joe took careful note of this information and again vowed to confirm it in person. The next time he was in London, months later, he nervously checked the birth records for July 1985. And are you sitting down? The details all checked out. A child named Thomas Hugh Graham was born on July 13th to Hugh and Susan Graham. In fact, the only detail to not check out was the birthplace. Rather than Kent, little Thomas was born 35 miles away in Aldershot, Hampshire. There's an odd postscript to this story. When Thomas had just turned 2, Joe took the controversial step of contacting the parents. He felt extremely awkward calling them out of the blue, but his curiosity was huge. You see, Joe had a deep knowledge and interest in children who claimed to remember past lives. Perhaps Thomas would be one of these children. Joe spoke with Thomas's father, Hugh, and explained who he was and how he came to get in touch with them. Joe was relieved that Hugh listened to all he had to say and responded by saying basically, "Well, I'm going to have to check all this out and see if you are legit before agreeing to any further contact." 3 days later, when they spoke again, Hugh confirmed that he had spoken with Joe's publisher and that he had confirmed that Joe was indeed who he said he was. But after discussing the matter with his wife, they could see no real advantage to pursuing things any further. And so with that phone call, their contact ended. But Joe was always left to wonder whether little Thomas had a particular fondness for playing with airplanes, or as he grew up, a deep and unexplainable interest in World War II. By now, Joe and his longtime girlfriend Rachel had broken up, and he was dating a beautiful Greek woman named Sylvia. I know. But having someone who could speak Greek came in handy. On their first meeting at Aviva's condo, Sylvia greeted the channeled Philippa by saying, in Greek, "My little lamb." To which Philippa instantly shot back, in Greek, "I am not woolly." On this particular night, Joe felt absolutely smitten. his dream lover, Philippa, and his real-life girlfriend, Sylvia, were bantering back and forth. It was almost as if they were fighting over possession of him. It was heady stuff and more than a little erotic. Joe was looking forward to making love with Sylvia that night, knowing that Philippa would be watching, and maybe, somehow, even participating. After the session was done, and Aviva, along with her guests, were eating and drinking like any Friday night party, Joe was surprised to see a familiar face in the crowd. A man named Sanford Ellison. Sanford had been a mainstay of the group, but recently he hadn't been around. They had never been particularly close, but for some reason Joe felt compelled to speak with him. He noticed that Sanford seemed different, anxious, quiet, withdrawn. He also looked thin and frail, almost ill. Maybe that's why he hasn't been around, Joe thought. Joe greeted him, and as they talked, Joe found himself telling Sanford excitedly that he would be traveling to Greece in a few months, and he planned on visiting the area where he and Philippa met and exploring the small town where they fell in love. But Sanford looked distressed, even scared, and his final strange words to Joe that night stayed with him as he flew across the Atlantic to walk the roads where he and his spirit guide Philippa had one day walked hand in hand as lovers. "Anytime you're ready to hear about the other side of the guides," Sanford said, "I'll be glad to tell you all that I know." The disaster began on September 11th, but the year was 1981. That was the day I got the part of Felix Unger in The Odd Couple. This was a huge upset. A sophomore had never been cast in a leading role before. Not because of any rule or tradition, it just hadn't ever happened. And the fact that I'd been cast over Michael Principato was nothing short of miraculous. I was thrilled, but I was also scared. It's like the minute I found out I got the part, a missile was fired from thousands of miles away, and it was headed straight for me. I wasn't sure when it was going to hit, but I knew it was going to hit, and there was nothing I could do about it. Michael cut through the crowd that was gathered in front of the cast list. Within seconds of me finding out that I had the role of Felix, and Michael had the supporting role of Speed, he suddenly appeared at my side and, a little louder than he needed to, congratulated me on getting the role. He grinned and shook my hand and said, "You deserve it," and then took off. Something about his quick exit scared me. But really, there wasn't anything he could have done that wouldn't have scared me. Publicly demonstrating that he was not a sore loser, and indeed the bigger man, only went so far. Deep down, I knew the missile was in the air, somewhere out there beyond the horizon, and it was all just a matter of time. The missile landed when the phone rang during dinner that night. I picked it up. It was Michael, but it took me a minute to understand what he was saying because he was crying. It was actually terrifying. I thought someone had died. He told me his dad had come home really drunk and they'd had the biggest fight they'd ever had, and he had to get out of there, and could he please come over and spend the night at my house? Well, of course he could. He'd stayed over at my house a million times. My parents loved Michael. I told him he could stay as long as he needed to. I was worried about him and I felt terrible. But on another level, this was perfect. This solved everything. I was being handed an opportunity to take care of Michael, to empathize with his pain, to comfort him and be the good, supportive friend. And none of it had anything to do with the play. My dad and I drove down to pick him up. Sure, he had basically ruined my night of victory, and he had found a way, tonight of all nights, to make it all about him. But on a much more basic level, I was relieved because our traditional roles had been reestablished. He would take center stage, and I would support him. For the moment, my betrayal could be set aside. And for a while, at least, our friendship would be a thing that we could both understand and trust. When Joe Fisher returned from his trip to Greece, He didn't feel like he could understand or trust anything. He felt the numb humiliation of a spurned lover, made worse by the fact that he'd never actually held his lover, looked into her eyes, or kissed her still living lips. Not in this life. He had gone to Greece to get as close as he could to the physical reality of Philippa, but she had stood him up. Joe had intended to make this pilgrimage with Philippa. For over a year, after countless hours of meditation, he finally made what he felt was actual psychic connection with her. He could think questions to her and receive answers from her. Answers that were then confirmed verbally during channeling sessions with Aviva. For instance, one day, while on a cross-country run up a steep hill, an odd idea suddenly implanted itself in his mind. Imagine that your feet are not touching the ground. Pretend instead that they are pushing off from midair just above the surface. Then, both physically and psychologically, the climb will be much easier. He tried, and to his surprise, it worked. From the book, quote, "When I next spoke to Philippa in a private session at Aviva's house, I asked whether she'd been speaking with me while I was out running. Yes, she replied evenly. I was telling you to imagine that your feet are replacing one above the other in the air." As he went through his daily life, Joe talked to Philippa constantly. And don't we all do this? A constant conversation in our minds with our partners. When my marriage to Michelle Goodwin ended, I remember that the most painful thing of all was the death of the imaginary world we had built together, the one based on the idea of ourselves as a couple. And it was this particular death that hit Joe the hardest. Everything Philippa had told him about their life together in Greece had turned out to be a lie. Detail after detail had proved false. The existence of Theros, the village where they met and fell in love, not only couldn't be confirmed, but based on the details she gave, could not possibly have ever existed. Her charming stories of visiting the coastal city of Alexandropolis turned sour when Joe learned that the city did not exist until almost 200 years after Philippa's death. Even the Greek dialect she spoke was apocryphal. Joe played tapes of her voice for multiple people, both in small villages and in big cities. No one could make out more than a few words, and even those extremely knowledgeable about Greek dialects admitted they had never heard anything like this. Many of the words she spoke were not even Greek. One listener identified the strange mishmash as an odd combination of Greek, Turkish, and Bulgarian. It's hard to do an emotional 180. One thing that mitigated the pain for Joe Fisher, a little, was that he was a professional writer of the paranormal, and everything he had done over the past few years, as emotionally seductive as it was still officially researched for a book he planned to write about channeling and spirit guides. So this wasn't a purely spiritual quest. This was business. But Joe still had a problem, and it was twofold. If the spirit guides were full of shit, he had no book. But also, if they were full of shit, what did that make him? A dupe. A sucker. A guy who walked into the ethers leading with his chin. And it was beginning to look like he got exactly what he deserved. The question he had asked his mother so many months ago came back to him. If the guides aren't who they say they are, who are they? And her answer still rang in his ears. They're demons. You're talking to demons. And I don't like the sound of it one bit. Soon after he arrived back in Toronto, Joe recalled seeing Sanford Ellison and hearing his cryptic comment. "Anytime you're ready to hear about the other side of the guides, I'll be glad to tell you all I know." Perhaps that time had come. It was now 2 months into rehearsals for The Odd Couple, and Herb was having trouble. As everyone expected, he got the role of Oscar, so I was playing opposite him. And over the last few weeks, we'd become better friends than we ever were before. The bulk of the play depends on our interaction, so it was pretty important that he and I learn to lean on each other and trust each other. But it was becoming clear that he didn't know his lines, and I didn't know mine well enough to be able to navigate around his fuck-ups, and Mr. Holthouse called an end to rehearsal an hour early that Friday, clearly pissed that neither one of us was totally off book and the show was only 2 weeks away. After rehearsal, a few of us were at Jim's Burgers getting dinner, and Michael suddenly went on like a 15-minute comedy routine about how hysterical it was that Herb didn't know his lines. He did impressions of Herb floundering and impressions of the look on my face when he floundered, and it was funny, I guess, just not to me. And even though he was making fun of Herb and technically sympathizing with me for having to share the stage with someone who was fucking up, there was a subtext. And the subtext was, this play is going to be bad. And so, it didn't matter if I was good or not, because Herb was going to fuck it up and we were both going to end up looking ridiculous. I laughed right along with everyone else, but I knew exactly what he was doing, and it really pissed me off. He had found a way to undermine me that weirdly came off like he was supporting me. It felt strange to be mad at Michael, but I was mad, and I decided to do something about it. That night, I called up Herb. Tomorrow was Saturday. I said we should get together and do the old actor's trick of just running lines. We'd spend all day if we had to. We would do all of our major scenes. We wouldn't do any acting. We'd just drill the lines, word for word, over and over, faster and faster, until we could do them in our sleep. And that's exactly what we did. When we showed up for the full run-through on Monday, we were word perfect. BK Holthouse was overjoyed, and so were we. Then, the week before we opened, Michael started giving me advice. Acting advice. You're hitting the punchlines too hard in Act 2. You're reaching for the laughs. In Act 1, try slowing things down. You're going so fast, you're going to lose the audience. And most of all, don't trust Herb. According to Michael, he was still playing everything too loud and too angry. And if I didn't want to get steamrolled, I was going to have to take control. This is your show, he said. He's stealing focus from you. You got to raise your game. Don't let him take the show away from you. I should have known what was happening, but I didn't. He was fucking with me, getting in my head, fucking me up. But it was all under the guise of being helpful. And that's what fucked me up the most, because he wasn't wrong. Maybe he really was trying to be helpful. Maybe he was still just trying to be my friend. Joe Fisher and Sanford Ellison met at a restaurant in downtown Toronto, and it is here, over a long meal that goes late into the night, that Joe begins to realize the danger he is in. Sanford was one of the first members of the channeling group, and early on, Russell Parnick, the sheep farmer from Yorkshire Dalles, took notice of him. Russell revealed to Sanford that he had latent healing powers and might, in the future, be called upon to help Aviva with her ongoing struggles with leukemia. In fact, from the very beginning, it was suggested that Sanford's karmic connection and karmic debt to Aviva was unusually strong. Apparently, they had shared various romantic and purely erotic relationships over the course of many lifetimes and were bonded spiritually in a way that made things a little awkward, considering that Sanford attended these meetings with his wife of almost 25 years, Betty. One night, Sanford was asked to stay behind after the other group members had gone home. When they were alone, Russell informed Sanford that Aviva's condition was declining, and she had less than 3 months to live. However, there was hope. Sanford's healing powers, coupled with his spiritual connection to Aviva, provided a unique opportunity for him to help her, and perhaps even save her life. Russell, along with Sanford's personal guide, Tuktu, and don't get me started on Tuktu, this is only a two-parter. But anyway, Russell and Tuktu would help the process by amplifying and directing Sanford's healing energy into Aviva's body. Not only would this improve her health, but it would also address Sanford's lingering karmic debt to Aviva. Apparently, Sanford had, you know, murdered Aviva a couple of times in the past, so, you know, there was that. Sanford took all this very seriously. I mean, if you were told you had the ability to save someone's life, wouldn't you at least try? Sanford had witnessed successful spirit healing rituals in the past. He knew they could work, and so he happily offered his services and was overjoyed when the sessions proved successful. Aviva was clearly improving. Sanford could feel the healing energy flowing from the guides through him and into Aviva. As Sanford describes it, quote, "My hands and fingers would get quite hot. I would know when the work was completed on a particular area because this sensation of heat would die away. The difficulty always lay in blanking out the conscious mind. In time, I could tell where the problem areas were. The direction was mine, but the healing energy came from the guides." But there was a downside. The healing sessions became almost constant, 4 or 5 times a week, and they could last for hours. Sanford would often be awakened in the middle of the night and told he had to come right away. So he would leave his wife Betty behind and go to be at Aviva's side. Family vacations were canceled. Even short weekend trips were not allowed because the spirits insisted that if Sanford missed even one treatment, it could mean the end of Aviva's life. When the spirits sensed Sanford's growing exhaustion and ambivalence, they began to actively undermine his relationship with his wife, Betty, telling him that she was standing in the way of his forward development and that their soul connection was weak and inconsequential, essentially a waste of his earthbound life. But it gets creepier. Russell and Tuktu began telling Sanford that his connection to Aviva was so profound that nothing less than a, quote, "complete and open acceptance of their bond was necessary to save her life." Yup, they wanted Sanford and Aviva to sleep together, all in the service of saving her life. Now, keep in mind, this wasn't some weird sexual gaslighting from Sanford to Aviva, or vice versa. Neither of them were attracted to each other, and they were both horrified by the spirit's insistence that they have sex. And for the record, they never did. But by the time things had gone this far, Sanford's life was in complete freefall. He was physically exhausted by the demands of the healing sessions. He had left Betty and moved out of his home. His business was collapsing, and he was spiraling into a depression so deep he even considered suicide. "I see now that they were brainwashing me," Sanford said. "It was magnificently done. They would scramble my thinking and feeling processes so that I wasn't able to function properly. And then they would be the ones to make me feel better. Practically every day I would get what you might call a maintenance shot, which would make me feel better for a while. They turned me into a psychic drug addict. The guides were out to create enormous dependency, and they succeeded." It was only after a huge argument between Aviva and Sanford that for a handful of days he was able to withdraw from her and the spirits. And that's when things began to turn around. Almost immediately, he began to feel better. The nagging doubts and confusion and self-loathing created and stoked by the spirits began to fade. And it was only now in the relative quiet that he finally began to question the spirit's true intentions. The first thing that occurred to him was, if the healing sessions were so essential to Aviva's health, why was she always constantly on the decline? Why was he always needed on call to bring her back from the brink of death? He checked in with her after a week of no communication to discover, to his surprise, that in the absence of the healing sessions, Aviva's condition had actually improved. But the spirits weren't through with him. Roger Bellancourt, Aviva's primary hypnotherapist, who discovered the spirit guides in the first place, called and said that Russell and Tuktu were demanding that Sanford return and continue with the healing sessions. They doubled down on their desire for Sanford and Aviva to sleep together, once again implying that if this didn't happen, she would die. But Sanford was on to them now. Roger held the phone to Aviva's mouth, and Russell's voice boomed across the line. Russell told Sanford in no uncertain terms that if he didn't obey, Aviva would die and he would fall into a depression and kill himself. And although it was difficult, Sanford ignored him. He smiled and gently hung up the phone. Over the course of the next 2 months, Aviva's health continued to improve. Sanford moved back in with his wife, and his life soon returned to normal. As the evening grew late, Joe once again asked the crucial question. If the spirit guides aren't who they say they are, who or what are they? After a moment of deep consideration, Sanford answered in this way, quote, I tend to feel that they are lower astral entities who play on human frailty and feed on our energy and our emotions. I still believe they helped to keep Aviva alive. They needed her alive. Our communication allows some light to shine into the darkness of where they are, and wherever that is must be god-awful in the extreme. By the next rehearsal for The Odd Couple, I was completely wound up. Michael Principato's voice kept ringing in my head. This show is yours. Don't let Herb steal it from you. Every time Herb got loud, I got louder. Every time he went big, I went bigger. I knew early on it wasn't working, I was messing up, but I just couldn't stop myself. When rehearsal ended, Mr. Holthouse asked me to stick around after the rest of the cast had been dismissed. He told me he didn't know what I was doing, but my performance was so out of control that he was actually considering canceling the show. At this point, I was completely freaked out. I could feel things spiraling out of my control. So, without naming names, I told him that some people had told me that Herb's performance was stealing focus and I had to raise my game or he was going to take the show away from me. Now, to his credit, Mr. Holthouse resisted pointing out what an idiot I was being. He reminded me that he was the director and Herb was my co-star, and if I had a problem, they were the people I should be discussing my feelings with. He suggested that maybe we needed to have a meeting. So we did. It turned out that Herb was still unsure about his lines, so he was compensating by making his readings louder and angrier. So Mr. Holthouse suggested we try the other actor's trick. He told us to lie down on the stage, with our heads next to each other, flat on our backs, and calmly whisper the lines to each other. And as we did, imagine we were confiding a deep secret to a close friend. I don't know who Herb thought about as we lay on that stage whispering our lines, but for me, I was talking to Michael. As Oscar and Felix fought the war of two complete opposites, I could feel a different battle building in my heart between two friends who were too much the same. I'm sorry, Michael. I'm so sorry. But I gotta go. The Odd Couple went up on the main stage at Alhambra High School on the second weekend in November, and it was a huge success. Both Herb and I nailed our performances every night for 3 nights, and it was a dream come true for me. And by the next week, I was no longer friends with Michael Principato. He didn't know it, but I did. And I realize now that it ultimately had nothing to do with him. I had to declare myself. I had to stop being his sidekick or anyone's sidekick. Could we have still been friends? Probably. But I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to have the brave and honest conversation that would have led to that. Standing up for myself, advocating for myself in a genuine way, required a level of self-esteem I simply did not have. If I stood up for myself, I knew, deep down, I would be destroyed. And so, I chose to approach things in a different way. I ghosted him. When he called, I wasn't home. At school, I found new routes to my classes, so I would never, ever run into him. On weekends, I was always busy. I hid from him for 5 months, all through spring semester of his senior year. Other friends would ask me what had happened. They'd tell me that Michael was talking about me, that he missed me, that something was wrong. I would get scared and defensive and say that he was acting crazy. There was nothing going on. He was just crazy. He left a letter in my mailbox one day, and I stared at it like it was a snake. Then I carefully carried it unopened around the side of our house and jammed it deep down into our trash can where no one would ever find it. I lived in absolute terror that he would approach me one day and ask to have a conversation. Because I knew somehow that the force of his personality and his emotional vulnerability would somehow convince me that I was wrong. And I wouldn't have the wherewithal to explain my feelings, and somehow I would be forced back into our friendship, one that only worked when he was at the center and I was off to the side. After a while, Michael stopped calling. Then he graduated, and that was that. That was the end of our friendship. Completely unresolved, I cut him off cold. It was ruthless and brutal, and I am certain he never truly knew why. Toward the end of the first edition of Hungry Ghosts, Joe Fisher admits that he wanted to confront the spirit guides one last time, to call out Russell and Tuktu, and finally Philippa, for their obvious deceptions, to unmask them in front of the Friday night crowd and reveal to everyone what they truly were. From the book. But even as I looked forward to a final showdown with the spirits, I knew they'd be much too clever for me. No matter how ironclad my arguments and purposeful my intent, they would call on their native brilliance to sidestep the issue and somehow make me the culprit. Finally, I decided the only worthwhile response was to write this book. The first nagging question Joe addresses in his conclusion of the book is, why would the spirits lie about their identities? If they truly meant to deceive, why not use the most obvious weapon at their disposal to prove their reliability, their true names? For the answer to this question, Joe turned to Dr. Joel Witten, a researcher and member of the Toronto Society for Psychical Research. Dr. Witten spent over 10 years studying trance mediums. He even listened to Joe's audio tapes of Russell. And his answer is quite simple. Quote, Russell is afraid of not existing. You've stepped on his fear. He's attached himself to the medium because it's his way of continuing his existence vicariously, of trying to assure himself that he's alive. In his need to exist, he's playing the role of guide. But he's a parasite. So are the others. Very troubled, frightened, neurotic entities. Joe stops him there. Troubled and frightened, maybe, but neurotic? How? Dr. Witten explains. The red flag of neurosis is to do something that reveals your fear. Sigmund Freud called it the compulsion to repeat. Unconsciously but deliberately, Russell and the others fed you false data so that they would be confronted with their worst fear, the fear that they do not exist. That's what they want to hear. That's what they're most afraid of. It's always been hard for me to imagine spirits that don't know they're dead. But as Joe Fisher points out, the subject is covered quite clearly and thoroughly in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The book describes earthbound spirits called pretas, or hungry ghosts. These are individuals who at the moment of death are unable to separate emotionally from human desire. They remain trapped on the lower planes and are, quote, filled with yearnings for the animal delights they can no longer directly taste. Have you ever wondered at the number of haunted bars, restaurants, brothels, and hotels? Well, what better place to indulge in your animal delights? The hungry ghosts are described as, quote, beings with tiny mouths, long thin necks, and gigantic bellies. The Tibetan Buddhists warn that it is just after death that we must be especially vigilant and resist the siren call of the hungry ghosts. Quote, together with the wisdom light, the soft yellow light of the hungry ghosts will also shine. Do not take pleasure in it. Give up desire and yearning. If you are attracted to it, you will fall into the realm of the hungry ghosts and experience unbearable misery from hunger and thirst. They are an obstacle. They block the path of liberation. Robert Monroe, the modern expert on out-of-body travel, reported seeing exactly this. A densely populated dead zone just beyond our physical existence, filled with spirits who refused to accept that they were dead. According to Monroe, they expended all their energy in trying to become physical again, or if possible, inhabit the bodies of still living people so they could experience the sensations of eating, drinking, and, you know, doing what grown-ups do when they meet each other on Tinder. Despite everything he went through, Joe Fisher ends the first edition of his book on a note of hope, asserting that he still believes there are, quote, wise and benevolent spiritual intelligences who are watching over us. I am simply less naive than before, and more aware than ever that the search for truth and greater awareness is fraught with tests and temptations. As the Odyssey continues, I can only reflect that the learning has been invaluable. And whoever is really looking after me out there, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. That's not the end of the story, of course. Hungry Ghosts was reprinted 11 years later in a first U.S. paperback edition and retitled The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts, Paraview Press, 2001. This is the only widely available edition, and it is in this edition that Joe includes an epilogue, which is anything but reassuring. In 1990, as he was finishing the first draft of the book that was to become Hungry Ghosts, Joe noticed a small red dot had appeared on his skin just above his navel. It rapidly grew into a painful, fluid-filled sore. He went to a doctor who prescribed antibiotics, but instead of clearing things up, the infection grew worse. Another visit to another doctor, this time at an emergency room in Toronto, resulted in more, stronger antibiotics and painkillers. But still, the infection worsened. At this time in his life, Joe was living in a remote cabin facing Adolphus Reach on the northeastern side of Lake Ontario. One night, during a raging blizzard, the pain from the infection became overwhelming. He limped to his car and drove himself through the snowstorm to the Prince Edward County Hospital in Picton. When the nurse lifted his shirt and removed the wound dressing, she gasped and cried out, "Oh my God," which is never what you want to hear from an emergency room nurse. He was given Demerol for the pain and rushed into surgery. When he woke up, his surgeon told him what had happened. He had somehow contracted omphalitis, an infection that is extremely rare in adults, but occasionally affects newborns. It is essentially an infection that occurs when the umbilical cord is cut. Joe couldn't help but be struck by the symbolic coincidence. His ongoing attempts to finally and completely cut the cord between himself and the guides were still difficult and painful. When the doctor left Joe's bedside, his phone rang. It was a woman named Claire LaForgia, a channeler that Joe had visited the previous year when he was seeking outside confirmation of the identities and information he was receiving from Aviva. Claire was very concerned about him and asked how he was. Joe said he was fine, but confused. How did she know he was in the hospital? He hadn't told anyone. Literally, no one knew he was there. How did she? "My spirit guide told me," she answered. Did the various guides communicate with each other beyond the veil? Were they all watching Joe, even as he put the finishing touches on a book that would finally blow their cover? Did Russell and Tuktu and Philippa somehow know about his rare infection? Had they, in fact, caused it? The site of the infection, the navel, is highly symbolic. To the ancient Greeks, omphalos meant center or hub. It is also the name of a sacred pyramid-shaped stone found in the temple of Apollo in Delphi. It was fabled to mark the center of the earth. From the word omphalos comes omphalitis. Joe regarded the pyramid-shaped mark on his belly that described the borders of his infection. His doctor told him if he had not made it into the hospital when he did, the abscess would likely have burst and the toxic fluid might have exploded internally. He could have died. Would the guides actually go so far as to try to kill him to keep his book from being published? The minute the idea formed in his mind, Joe dismissed it as absurd. But soon after the book was published, letters started coming in. People all over the world wrote to Joe, sharing stories about their own run-ins with the guides. Tales of people who reached into the darkness to find some sort of knowledge, but instead found spirits all too eager to attach themselves, promising enlightenment, but always eventually turning to abuse, manipulation, and control. One woman wrote that her spirit teacher offered to train her. Quote, "I felt so much love and support from her, but then I began to feel strangely ill. For no apparent reason, long waves of severe nausea would grip me. You're not ill, the spirit told me. It's the training." She then showed me it was her doing it. She turned the sensations on and then turned them off again, then on again, to show me. I didn't like it. Then I heard my teacher conversing with another unseen voice that asked if I'd ever considered suicide. That's when she knew she was in trouble. In her letter, she told Joe it took everything she had to break ties with the spirit. It didn't want to go, and when it realized that that was the woman's goal, it fought back, dug in, and refused to leave. It took months, but the woman was finally successful in ridding herself of the spirit. This letter was one of hundreds. While the first edition of Hungry Ghosts ends on a note of hope, the second edition does not. In the intervening years between the editions, Joe's life took some dark turns. His fortunes did not flourish. After recounting his own emotional struggles, as well as those of others, he admits he's glad he wrote the book, if for no other reason than to warn people not to make the same mistakes he did. These are his final words. Quote, "I am simply grateful to have survived my confrontation with the liars and deceivers of the spirit world. Only when the struggle was far advanced did I finally comprehend the meager state of my resources, as well as the might and swiftness of the unseen enemy. Let this be a warning to all. Joe Fisher committed suicide on May 9, 2001, just after the publication of The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts. Close friends reported that Joe was suffering from depression brought on by financial problems, chronic back pain, and the end of his marriage. However, in one of his last communications with his editor at Paraview Press, Fisher stated that he felt the spirits were still after him for having written his final book. It was now a full week after I set aside The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts, and my brother had told me about how he'd run into Michael Principato. I couldn't stop thinking about it. Mostly, I was thinking of the good times, all the fun we'd had, and how exciting it was to be around him, and how my whole world opened up in the year that I first knew him and we were best friends. How that bus trip to Monterey changed everything in the course of a weekend, and how that summer made me who I am today. That had to count for something, didn't it? What was I so afraid of? I had treated him like shit. Thinking about that made me feel bad about myself. But maybe that was the most compelling reason of all that I should call him. Could we talk it through? Would he pretend like it had never happened? Or would he have perspective on the whole thing, and would he understand on some level why it was I had essentially broken up with him? After all this time, could we have mercy on the people we had been, when after all, we had just been kids? Fuck it. One morning I decided to call him. I got his phone number from my brother and worked up my courage and dialed. The phone rang. I was ridiculously nervous, so stupidly scared. What would he sound like? What would he say? I tried to orient myself emotionally. I'm calling because once upon a time, we were best friends. And that time meant something to me. And I'm sorry it ended badly, and that is completely my fault. But Michael, you were a good friend, and you didn't deserve what I did to you. But now some time has passed. Maybe we don't become friends again, but maybe we at least become okay with each other. Maybe we go out, have dinner, steak and Coca-Cola, and talk about the old stuff. Steven Spielberg movies and James Bond novels and Billy Joel albums. And we'll raise a toast to those two kids who we used to be, who were absolutely sure they were going to go out and slay the world together, like Artemis and Spectre, going up against an enormous fire-breathing dragon, cracking jokes as purple fire exploded all around us, our victory never in question for a minute. The phone kept ringing and finally went to voicemail. I left a message, just a short one, but I threw the door wide open. I said I missed him and it had been way too long and I would love to get together. Then I hung up. I waited all afternoon for him to call back. That was 19 years ago. I'm waiting still. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. We'll be back again soon for the premiere of Season 4. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time for a special bonus episode, my conversation with UFO expert, UFO witness, host of the Our Strange Skies podcast, and my good friend, Rob Christofferson. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.